The special laws I. The classes of the particular laws, the so-called 10 words, have been treated with precision in the previous treatise. Now the individual statutes must be examined in the order the scripture follows. I will begin with the one that most people laugh at. What draws the laughter is the circumcision of the male generative organ, though it is a practice taken seriously by other nations too, and especially by the Egyptians, a people thought to be the most populous, the most ancient, and the most philosophical. For this reason, it would have been more sensible and more dignified to set aside childish mockery and investigate instead the reasons that have kept this custom in force, rather than rushing to condemn the thoughtlessness of great nations. Considering, as one reasonably should, that so many tens of thousands undergo this cutting in every generation, mutilating, with great pain, their own bodies and those of their nearest kin. Many considerations recommend preserving and carrying out what the ancients instituted, but the highest are four. One is relief from a harsh and hard-to-cure disease of the foreskin, which they call anthrax, taking its name, I think, from its smoldering and burning, an ailment that arises more easily in those who retain the foreskin. Second is cleanliness of the whole body, fitting for a consecrated order. This is why the priests in Egypt go so far as to shave their bodies entirely, since impurity collects there too. Some things that need purifying are covered over by both hair and foreskin. Third is the resemblance of the excised part to the heart. Both organs are prepared for generation. The one, the breath centered in the heart, generates thoughts. The other, the generative organ, generates living creatures. For the men of old thought it right to make the visible and perceptible part, from which perceptible things naturally come to be, resemble the invisible and superior part, through which intelligible things are constituted. Fourth, and most necessary of all, is its usefulness for abundant offspring. For it is said that the seed travels more successfully when it neither scatters nor pools in the folds of the foreskin. Hence the circumcised among the nations are held to be the most fertile and the most populous. These reasons, then, have come to our ears, handed down as ancient lore among inspired men who examined the writings of Moses with no casual attention. But beyond what has been said, I hold that circumcision is also a symbol of two of the most necessary things. One is the excision of pleasures, all the pleasures that bewitch the understanding. Since the union of man and woman carries off the prize among all the enchantments that pleasure works, the lawgivers thought it right to maim the organ that serves such intercourse, hinting thereby that circumcision means the excision of excessive and overflowing pleasure. Not of one pleasure only, but through that one, the most compelling of all, of every other pleasure as well. The other reason is that a person should come to know himself and cast off that grave disease of the soul, self-conceit. For some, priding themselves as if they were skilled molders of living things, have boasted that they are able to fashion man, the most beautiful of all creatures, and, puffed up with arrogance, have deified themselves, veiling over the God who is truly the cause of generation, though they could have corrected this deception from the evidence right in front of them. For among them, there are many men who are sterile and many women who are barren, whose unions remain fruitless and who grow old childless. This wicked opinion of the mind, then, must be excised, along with every other opinion that is not devoted to God. So much, then, for these matters. We must now turn to the particular laws, and first to those from which it is fitting to begin, the laws laid down concerning monarchy. The laws concerning monarchy. Some have supposed the sun and moon and the other stars to be independent, sovereign gods, and have attributed to them the causes of everything that happens. But to Moses, the world seemed to be both a created thing and, as it were, the greatest city having rulers and subjects, rulers being all the heavenly bodies, both the planets and the fixed stars, and subjects being the natures beneath the moon, in the air and around the earth. These so-called rulers, however, are not autonomous, but are lieutenants of the one Father of all, and in imitating his oversight they succeed in governing, each in accordance with justice and law, everything that has come into being. But those who do not perceive the charioteer mounted above and directing them, as it were self-acting agents of what happens in the world, fasten the causes upon the yoked animals themselves. This ignorance the most sacred lawgiver corrects into knowledge, saying, "Lest, having seen the sun and the moon and the stars and the whole array of heaven, you go astray and worship them dute." 4:19. Very aptly and rightly, he called the acceptance of these things as gods a-going astray. For those who saw the seasons of the year established by the sun's advances and withdrawals, seasons within which the generation of animals and plants and fruits is brought to completion according to fixed cycles of time, and the moon serving as the sun's attendant and successor, taking up by night the care and oversight of what the sun tends by day, and the other stars, through their sympathetic bond with things on earth, working and producing countless effects for the preservation of the whole. These people went astray in an endless wandering, supposing that these bodies alone were gods. But had they been eager to walk the unwandering road, they would immediately have recognized that just as sensation has become the subordinate servant of mind, in the same way all perceptible things have been established as servants of the intelligible, and they would have been content to attain second prize. For it is utterly absurd to think that the mind within us, though smallest and invisible, is the leader of our organs of sensation, while the mind of the universe, the greatest and most perfect of all, is not by nature king of kings, seen by nothing, though it sees all that is seen. All the gods of heaven, then, whom sensation surveys, must be considered not sovereign in their own right, but as having received the rank that belongs to them, brought under authority by their very nature, though on account of their virtue they will not be called to account. So then, transcending in our reasoning the whole of visible being, let us go on to honor the one who is formless and invisible and apprehensible by thought alone, who is not only God of the gods perceived by intellect and by sense, but also craftsman of them all. And if anyone assigns the worship due to the eternal maker to some other, younger, created thing, let him be recorded as deranged and guilty of the gravest impiety. There are some who have handed gold and silver over to sculptors as capable of fashioning gods. These, taking the inert material and using a mortal model, most absurd of all, have shaped what merely appear to be gods. And having built temples and set up altars, they honor them with sacrifices and processions and all the other rites and consecrations, performed with the utmost care and deliberation, while priests and priestesses lend the utmost solemnity to the delusion surrounding them. To these the Father of all proclaims in advance, saying, "You shall not make gods of silver and gold along with me," Exod 20, 23, all but openly teaching that you shall fashion no god at all as handiwork out of any other material either, being barred from the finest materials, for silver and gold hold the first rank among all materials. Apart from this explicit prohibition, it seems to me he is also hinting at something else, bearing directly on the formation of character, and censuring with no small force those who love money, who procure silver and gold from every quarter, and then guard what they have procured in inner vaults like a divine image, believing it to be the cause of all good things and of happiness entire. And all those among the poor who are gripped by that harsh disease, love of money, having no wealth of their own worthy of such devotion, gape in awe at their neighbor's wealth, and, bowing before it, arrive at the houses of the rich at dawn, as if at the greatest temples, to pray and to beg good things from their masters as though from gods. It is to these that he says elsewhere too, "You shall not follow idols, and you shall not make molten gods," Lev. 19:4, teaching by way of symbols that it is not fitting to render honors equal to gods to wealth, for the notorious materials of wealth are, by nature, gold and silver, which the many follow, believing them to be the sole or chief causes of what is called blind happiness. These are what he calls idols. They resemble shadows and phantoms, hung on nothing strong or stable. They are carried about like an unsteady wind, taking on every kind of turn and change. Here is clear proof of this. Sometimes, before people have taken hold of them, wealth flies to them all at once, and just when they think they have it firmly in their grasp, it leaps away again, and even when it is present, it appears, like the images in mirrors, deceiving and bewitching the senses, seeming to stand there while having no real existence at all. And what need is there to show that human wealth, or rather the vain conceit that empty opinions paint up, is unstable? Some have said that all other living things and plants too, which come into being and perish, are constantly and unceasingly flowing away, but that the flux is too faint for perception, since the keenness of our sight is always overtaken by the swiftness of the flow before it can register an exact impression. But it is not only wealth and reputation and things of that kind that are idols and feeble shadows. So too are all the beings the mythmakers fashioned and inflated with false conceit, fortifying their lying opinions against the truth, bringing in new gods as if from a stage machine, so that the eternal God who truly exists might be delivered over to forgetfulness. And to make their falsehood easier to swallow, they set it to melodies, rhythms, and meters, thinking thereby to bewitch with ease those who encountered it. Beyond this, they also enlisted sculpture and painting as accomplices in the deception, so that, through forms well-crafted in colors, shapes, and qualities, they might lead astray those who looked upon them, luring the two ruling senses, sight and hearing, the one with lifeless beauties, the other with poetic euphony, and so seize the soul, rendering it unstable and unmoored. Knowing this, that this vain conceit had advanced to great power, escorted by the greater part of humankind, not by compulsion, but by their own free choice. He was on guard lest even the zealots of true and uncorrupted piety be swept away by it as by a torrent, and so he stamps deep impressions on their minds, engraving there the marks of holiness, so that these might never be blurred, worn smooth, or dimmed by time. And he continually chants the same refrain, saying now that God is one and is the founder and maker of all things, now that he is Lord of everything that has come to be, since stability, permanence, and true authority belong in reality to him alone. It has been said, all who cling to the God who truly is, live, duet, 4:4. Is not this the thrice blessed and thrice happy life, to hold fast in love to the service of the most venerable cause of all things, and not to think it fitting to serve the underlings and gatekeepers ahead of the king? This life is immortal and long-lasting, inscribed on the very pillars of nature, and these letters must endure as long as the world itself endures. The father and ruler of the universe is, then, hard to conceive and hard to grasp, but that is no reason to shrink from the search for him. In inquiries about God, the mind of the genuine philosopher runs into two supreme difficulties. First, whether the divine exists at all, on account of those who have practiced atheism, the greatest of vices, and second, what he is in his essence. The first is not too laborious to see. The second is not only difficult, but perhaps even impossible. Both must be examined. Now, the things that are made are always in some way marks of recognition of those who made them. Who, on seeing statues or paintings, has not at once thought of a sculptor or a painter? Who, on seeing clothing or ships or houses, has not conceived a notion of a weaver, a shipwright, a builder? And someone who enters a well-governed city, where the arrangements of the Constitution are set in excellent order, what else will he suppose than that this city is overseen by good rulers? So then, whoever arrives at this truly great city, the world, and beholds the mountains and the plains teeming with animals and plants, with rivers native to the land and the rush of winter torrents, the spreading expanse of the seas, the tempering of the air, and the turning of the seasons of the year, and then the sun and moon, the rulers of day and night, and the circuits and dances of the other planets and of the fixed stars and of the whole heaven, must he not, reasonably, indeed of necessity, form a conception of its maker and father, and, further, its ruler? For none of the works of skill comes into being of itself, and this world is the most skillfully and most scientifically made of all things, so that it must have been fashioned by one whose knowledge was altogether good and most perfect. In this way, we arrive at a conception of the existence of God. As for his essence, even though it turns out to be hard to track down and hard to grasp, it must nonetheless be searched out as far as possible. For nothing is better than seeking the true God, even if the finding of him escapes human power, since the very eagerness to wish to learn produces, in itself, unspeakable pleasures and joys. Witnesses to this are those who have tasted philosophy not merely with the tips of their lips, but have feasted more fully on its arguments and doctrines. For the reasoning of such people, lifted up on high from the earth, walks the upper air and travels round together with the sun and moon and the whole heaven, longing to see everything there. Yet its impressions grow fainter, since a pure and abundant light is being poured out, so that the eye of the soul grows dizzy at the flashing brilliance. But even so, worn out by the effort, it does not give up. With unconquered resolve, it presses on toward whatever vision is possible, as though competing in a contest for second prize, since it has failed to win the first. Second to true perception come conjecture and inference, and whatever else belongs to the class of the reasonable and the plausible. Just as, though we neither know nor are able to determine clearly what each of the stars is in its essence, we are nonetheless eager to inquire, taking delight in plausible accounts for the sake of our natural love of learning. In the same way, even if we have no share in a clear perception of God who truly exists, we ought not to abandon the search for him, since the very inquiry, even without discovery, is in itself deeply to be desired. No one blames his own bodily eyes because, unable to look upon the sun itself, they see the streaming radiance of its rays falling on the earth, the furthest reach of the sun's own light. It was with an eye to this that the Hierophant, Moses, most beloved of God, besought God, saying, "Show yourself to me," Exod. 33:13, all but seized and crying aloud outright, that this world has become for me a teacher and guide to the fact that you are and exist, teaching me, as a son teaches of a father, and as a work teaches of its craftsman. But as for what you are in your essence, though I long to know it, I find no guide to this lesson in any part of the universe. Therefore I beg and implore you to accept the supplication of a man who is a suppliant and a lover of God, and who asks to serve you alone. For just as light, unrecognized by another, is its own mark of recognition, so too you alone could reveal yourself. Therefore I ask to find pardon, if, for want of a teacher, I have dared to take refuge in you, in my eagerness to learn about you. And he says, "Your eagerness I accept as praiseworthy, but your request fits nothing that belongs to created being. What is my own I grant freely to whoever is to receive it, for it is not the case that everything easy for me to give is also possible for a human being to receive. Hence, I extend to the one worthy of grace every gift that he is capable of receiving. But my own comprehension, not even the nature of a human being, nor indeed the whole heaven and the world, will be able to contain. Know yourself, then, and do not be carried away by impulses and desires beyond your power, and do not let a passion for the unattainable seize and lift you off your feet, for of the things attainable you will lack none." Hearing this, he came with a second supplication and says, "I am persuaded by your instruction that I would not have had the strength to receive the clear vision of your own appearance, but I beg to behold, at least, the glory that surrounds you," Exod. 33:18. "And I think your glory to be the powers that stand guard about you, the comprehension of which, escaping me until now, works in me no small longing to know them." And he answers and says, "The powers you seek are invisible and wholly intelligible, belonging to me who am invisible and intelligible. And when I call them intelligible, I do not mean those already grasped and swallowed up by mind, but that, were they capable of being grasped at all, it would not be sense perception, but the purest mind that would grasp them. Though by nature ungraspable in their essence, they nevertheless display a certain impression and image of their own activity, like the seals among you. When wax, or some similar material, is applied to them, they stamp countless impressions without losing any part of themselves, remaining just as they were. In the same way, one must suppose that the powers around me endow qualities upon what has no quality and shapes upon what is shapeless, without themselves being altered or diminished in any part of their eternal nature. And some among those skilled in etymology among you name them not without purpose as ideas, since they give form to each of the things that exist, setting in order what is disordered, bringing limit and boundary to what is unbounded and undefined and shapeless, giving it shape, and in general transforming the worse into the better. So then, hope never that you will be able to grasp, in its essence, either me or any of my powers. But of the things attainable, as I have said, I readily and eagerly grant a share. These consist in the invitation to behold the world and the things within it, a vision that comes about not through the eyes of the body, but through the sleepless eyes of the mind. Only let the longing for wisdom be constant and unbroken, wisdom which fills those who study under her and come to know her with doctrines celebrated in song and of the utmost beauty. Hearing this, he did not cease from his desire, but kindled all the more his longing for the things unseen. And he welcomes all who resemble these men, whether they were such from the beginning or have become better by changing to the superior order. The former because they have not abandoned their nobility of birth, the latter because they have thought fit to migrate toward piety, and these he calls proselytes, from there having come over to a new and God-loving commonwealth, men who disregard mythical fictions and hold fast to unadulterated truth. At any rate, granting equal honor to all newcomers and anointing them with the same privileges he urges upon the native-born, the well-born, he bids the latter honor the former not only with marks of esteem, but with a special friendship and exceptional goodwill. And rightly so, no doubt. Having left, he says, fatherland and friends and kinsmen for the sake of virtue and holiness, let them not go without other cities, other households, other friends, but let there be places of refuge standing ready for those who desert to piety. For the honor paid to the one God is the most effective of love charms and an unbreakable bond of unifying goodwill. But he does not command, though he grants newcomers equality before the law and equal taxation, on the ground that they have condemned their ancestral and inherited delusion, that they should use unbridled speech and an unchecked tongue in blaspheming those whom others believe to be gods, lest those others, provoked, be stirred to utter what is not lawful against him who truly is. For through ignorance of the difference, since from childhood they have been taught the falsehood as truth and have grown up familiar with it, they would fall into sin. But as for those of the nation itself, if any relax their honor of the one, since they have abandoned the most essential rank of piety and holiness, they ought to be punished with the utmost penalties, choosing darkness before the most radiant light and rendering blind a mind that was capable of keen sight. And it is a fine thing to have been entrusted, all who have zeal for virtue, with exacting punishments by their own hand without delay, bringing the offenders neither to a courtroom nor to a council chamber nor to any authority at all, but employing the passion at hand, hatred of evil and love of God, to inflict inexorable chastisement on the impious, considering themselves, for that moment, everything. Counselors, judges, generals, assemblymen, accusers, witnesses, laws, people, so that with nothing standing in the way, they might fight fearlessly and with full confidence for holiness. There is recorded in the laws a man who dared this noble deed of daring. For when he saw certain men consorting with foreign women, and on account of their passion for them, disregarding their ancestral ways and being initiated into the mythical rites, and saw the one who was ringleader and chief of this transgression already growing bold enough to display his impious act openly, publicly offering sacrifices, unlawful sacrifices, to images and carved idols, in plain view of the whole crowd in its frenzy, he shut off from the spectacle those who had gathered on either side, and without hesitation slew him together with the woman, the man because it was profitable that others unlearn what he had taught, the woman because she had become a teacher of evils. This deed, done suddenly in the heat of the moment, admonished countless others who were preparing to do the same. God then, praising this feat of valor, performed with self-commanded and voluntary zeal, crowns him with a double gift, peace and priesthood. With the one, judging that a man who had taken up the contests on behalf of God's honor deserved to lay claim to a life free of war. With the other, because priesthood, the most fitting prize for a pious man, promises the service of the Father, to whom to be a slave is not merely better than freedom, but better even than sovereignty itself. But some men have carried their madness to such an excess that, leaving themselves no room even for a change of heart, they rush headlong into slavery to things made by hand, confessing that slavery in writing, not on scraps of paper, as is the custom with purchased slaves, but branding it upon their own bodies with heated iron, for permanent retention, for not even time can dim marks like these. A like resolve the most sacred Moses evidently strives to preserve in absolutely every other matter as well, being a lover of truth and its teacher, a truth which he desires to engrave and stamp upon all his disciples, banishing false opinions far from their understanding. Knowing, at any rate, that divination cooperates not a little with the wandering life of the many, leading them astray, he permits no use of any of its forms, and drives out of his own commonwealth all who court its favor. Sacrificers, purifiers, birdwatchers, interpreters of portents, enchanters, those who put their trust in omens. For all these are mere guessers at what is plausible and probable, catching different impressions at different times from the same phenomena, because the things underlying their art possess no fixed nature, nor has their reasoning acquired any exact test by which what is credible might be tested. All these practices are preparations for impiety. Why? Because the one who attends to them and is persuaded by them disregards the cause of all things, supposing that these alone are the causes of good and evil, and does not perceive that he is fastening the cares of his life to the most unstable of moorings, birds and feathers and their flight this way and that through the air, and creeping things that crawl low on the ground, which creep up from their burrows in search of food, and further, entrails and blood and dead bodies, which, deprived of soul, at once decay and are confounded, and, being altered, exchange their proper natures for a change to the worse. For he requires that the one enrolled in the commonwealth, governed by the laws, be perfect, not in the things in which the many have been trained, divinations and omens and plausible conjectures, but in matters concerning God that admit of no ambiguity or doubt, but only undoubting and naked truth. But since in all men there is implanted a longing for knowledge of the future, and because of this longing they turn to the sacrificial art and the other forms of divination, as though through them they would discover what is clear, while these arts are full of much obscurity and are ever refuted by their own inconsistencies, he forbids them to pursue these very earnestly, but says that if they are unswervingly pious, they shall not go without foreknowledge of things to come, but rather that some prophet, suddenly appearing, possessed by God, will speak oracles and prophesy, saying nothing of his own, for he who is truly possessed and in a frenzy cannot even comprehend what he is saying. But whatever is sounded within him, he will utter, as though another were prompting him. For prophets are interpreters of God, who makes use of their organs of speech to reveal whatever he wishes. Having said this and things akin to it concerning the conception of the one God, who truly is, he goes on to describe the manner in which honor must be rendered to him. Concerning the sanctuary. The highest and, in very truth, the sanctuary of God one must consider to be the whole universe, having as its shrine the most holy part of existing reality, heaven, as its votive offerings the stars, and as its priests the angels, his ministering powers, incorporeal souls, not compounds of rational and irrational nature, as ours happen to be, but holy and entirely intellectual, pure reasonings, made like unto the monad. But there is also the sanctuary made by hands. For it was necessary not to check the impulses of men who contribute to piety and wish either to give thanks by sacrifices for the good things that befall them, or to ask pardon and forgiveness for their sins. He took forethought, too, that many sanctuaries should not be built in many places, nor many in the same place, judging that, since God is one, there should be only one sanctuary. Then, to those who wish to perform sacred rites in their own homes, he does not permit it, but bids them rise up from the ends of the earth and journey to this one place, at the same time taking from this the most necessary test of character. For a man who is not going to sacrifice in a devout manner would never endure to leave fatherland and friends and kinsmen to live as a stranger abroad. Rather, it seems that a man is drawn by a pull stronger than any other, that toward piety, and so endures to be torn away from his most familiar and dearest things, as though from limbs joined to his own body. And the clearest proof of this is what actually happens. For countless people from countless cities, some by land, some by sea, from east and west and north and south, put in at the sanctuary on each feast, as though at some common harbor and safe haven from the meddling and most turbulent life, seeking to find fair weather and to be released, for a brief span, from the cares by which they have been yoked and pressed down from their earliest age, so as to pass their time in cheerful good spirits. And, filled with good hopes, they devote this most necessary leisure to holiness and the honoring of God, forming friendships also with those till then unknown, and through sacrifices and libations, bringing about a blending of characters into the surest pledge of concord. Of this sanctuary, the outermost enclosure, being greatest in both length and breadth, is fortified with four porticos worked to the utmost costliness. And each of these is double, constructed with an unstinting supply of timber and stone, with the skill of craftsmen and the diligence of those set over the work, a most perfect piece of work. While the inner porticos are shorter, though of a more austere construction. In the very center stands the shrine itself, surpassing all description, as one may conjecture from what appears outwardly. For the things within are invisible to everyone except the one high priest, and even to him it is granted to enter only once a year, and all is unseen even then. For he carries in a firepan full of coals and incense, and since much vapor naturally rises, everything round about is enveloped, and the sight is darkened and checked, unable to penetrate further. And though it stands on lower ground, being the greatest and loftiest of structures, it falls short of none of the tallest mountains. Now works that exceed all bounds in their architecture are conspicuous and admired by onlookers, especially by visiting foreigners, who, comparing them with the constructions of public buildings in their own cities, are struck with amazement at their beauty together with their costliness. But there is no sacred grove within the enclosure, by the ordinance of the law, for many reasons. First, because the true sanctuary seeks not pleasure and agreeable diversion, but austere sanctity. Second, because it is not lawful to bring in the things that nourish the greenery of trees, namely the refuse of men and irrational animals. And third, because the timber of wild growth is of no use whatever, but is, as the poets say, a burden upon the earth, while that of cultivated trees, bearing cultivated fruit, would seduce the shallow-minded away from the solemnity proper to sacred rites. Besides this, thickly wooded places and deep groves are the haunts of evildoers, who find safety in being screened from view and the chance to make sudden ambushed attacks on whomever they wish. Whereas open spaces, spread out and unobstructed on every side, with nothing to block the view, are most fitting for a sanctuary, allowing an exact view of those who enter and linger within. In addition, thickets and dense woodlands are dens for wrongdoers, who gain security from being hidden in shade and can launch sudden attacks from ambush against whomever they wish. Whereas open spaces, spread out and unobstructed on every side, with nothing blocking the view, are most fitting for a temple, allowing an exact view of those who enter and remain within it. The temple has revenues not only from allotments of land, but also from other, far greater sources that will never be destroyed by any length of time. For as long as the human race endures, and it will endure forever, the temple's revenues will likewise be preserved, lasting on together with the whole world. For it has been ordained that each person, beginning at 20 years of age, bring in first fruits every year. These contributions are called ransoms, and for this reason people make their first fruits offerings most eagerly, bright and joyful, since they expect that, along with the deposit, they will find release from slavery or a cure for diseases, and will reap both the most secure freedom and safety for all time. Since the nation is exceedingly populous, it follows naturally that its first fruits are also most abundant. Indeed, in practically every city there are treasuries for the sacred funds, to which it is customary for people to come and offer their first fruits. And at set times, sacred envoys are chosen by vote from the best men in each place, selected for excellence, to convey the safe hopes of each community. For in these lawful first fruits lie the hopes of the pious. Concerning priests. The nation has 12 tribes, and one out of all of them, chosen for excellence, holds the priesthood. A prize for its manly virtue and its zeal for God, granted at the time when the multitude seemed to have sinned by following the foolish opinions of some, who persuaded them to emulate the Egyptian folly and the native delusion that fabricates myths about irrational animals and especially about bulls. For when that tribe, of its own accord, killed all the leaders of that madness down to the young men, they were judged to have performed a holy act, having fought through the contests on behalf of piety. These are the laws concerning priests. It is ordained that the priest be whole and complete in every part, having no defect in his body, neither from some part lacking or having been amputated, nor from some excess part that grew along with his birth or was later added through disease, nor from a change of complexion into leprosy or savage lichen sores or warty growths or any other eruptions of rashes, all of which seem to me to be symbols of the perfection that concerns the soul. For if the priest's body, mortal by nature, must be inspected so that it suffer no misfortune in any part, much more must the immortal soul be inspected, which they say was formed after the image of the existing one. And reason is the image of God, through which the whole world was fashioned. after the requirement of noble birth from patrician stock, and perfection in body and in soul, there is next legislated the matter of the vestments, which the priest must put on when he is about to perform the sacred ministrations. The vestment is a linen tunic and a loincloth, the latter for covering the private parts, which it is not lawful to bear beside the altar, the former for the sake of swiftness in service. For it is in tunics alone, ungirded by any outer robe, that the priests, trained for the utmost speed, bring forward the sacrificial victims and the prayers and libations and everything else useful for the sacrifices. The high priest, too, has been directed to put on a similar vestment whenever he goes into the inner sanctuary to burn incense, since the linen, unlike wool, is not produced from anything that dies. But he has also been ordained to wear another vestment, of very elaborate workmanship, so as to seem a likeness and representation of the cosmos. Its construction is clear proof of this. For first there is a rounded garment, entirely of hyacinth blue throughout, a tunic reaching to the feet, a symbol of air, since air too is by nature dark, and in a sense reaches to the feet, stretching from the regions beneath the moon above down to the lowest recesses of the earth. Then over this, a woven piece shaped like a breastplate, a symbol of heaven. For on the shoulder pieces are two stones of emerald, the most precious material, one on each side, round, representations of the two hemispheres, of which the one is above the earth and the other beneath it. Then upon the breast, 12 costly stones of differing colors, arranged in 3 rows of 4, fashioned after the model of the zodiac. For that circle too, consisting of 12 signs, produces the 4 seasons of the year, allotting 3 signs to each. The whole place is aptly called the oracle, since everything in heaven has been fashioned and set in order by reasons and by proportions, for of the things there, nothing at all is without reason. And upon the oracle, he weaves in 2 ornaments of contrasting color, calling the one manifestation and the other truth. By truth, he hints that no falsehood at all may set foot in heaven, but the whole of it has been banished into the region around the earth, where it takes up residence in the souls of polluted men. And by manifestation, that the natures in heaven make manifest each of the things among us, which by themselves would be entirely unknowable. The clearest proof of this, if the sun, that unfailing sun, did not shine forth, how could the innumerable qualities of bodies have become visible, and how the manifold forms of colors and shapes? And who has revealed days and nights, months and years, and time altogether, if not the harmonious revolutions, beyond all reckoning of the moon, the sun, and the other stars? And who has revealed the nature of number, if not what has been said, according to the combinations of the divisions of time? And who has cut open and revealed to sailors the paths across the sea and its many expanses, if not the turnings and circuits of the stars? Wise men, too, having observed countless other things, have recorded them, taking their signs from the heavens for calms and violent winds, abundance and scarcity of crops, mild and blazing hot summers, extraordinary winters and spring-like ones, droughts and heavy rains, fruitfulness of animals and plants, and, conversely, barrenness of both, and all such things. For the signs of everything on earth are inscribed in heaven. At the lowest parts of the foot-length robe hang golden pomegranates, bells, and flower ornaments. These are symbols of earth and water, the flowers of earth, inasmuch as everything sprouts and blooms from it, and the pomegranates, so named appropriately from their flowing, rices, of water, while the bells represent the harmony, concord, and unison of the parts of the cosmos. The arrangement, too, is well conceived. Highest, where the stones are, is what is called the breastpiece, a likeness of heaven, since heaven, too, is highest. Below it is the foot-length robe, entirely hyacinth blue throughout, since the air, being dark, has been allotted the rank second after heaven, while the flowers and pomegranates are at the very lowest edge, since earth and water have obtained the lowest portion of the whole. Such is the construction of the sacred vestment, an outfit, a representation of the universe, a marvelous work both to look upon and to contemplate, for it presents an appearance most striking, such as no woven fabric among us can match for elaborateness combined with costliness, and it offers a philosophical understanding of the meaning of its several parts. For its purpose is, first, that the high priest have a visible image of the universe upon himself, so that from the continual sight of it, he may render his own life worthy of the nature of the whole. And second, that in the sacred rites the whole cosmos may join him in ministering. For it is most fitting that the one consecrated to the Father of the cosmos should also bring with him the Son, namely the All, for the service of the one who fashioned and begot it. There is also a third symbolism of the sacred vestment that must not pass unmentioned. Whereas the priests of other peoples are accustomed to offer their prayers and sacrifices only on behalf of their own kin, friends, and fellow citizens, the high priest of the Jews offers prayers and thanksgivings not only on behalf of the whole human race, but also on behalf of the parts of nature: earth, water, air, fire, considering the cosmos, which in truth it is to be his own homeland, on whose behalf he is accustomed to propitiate the ruler with supplications and entreaties, imploring him to share his gracious and merciful nature with what he has made. Having said this beforehand, he goes on to legislate further, commanding that whoever approaches the altar and touches the sacrifices, during the time appointed for him to carry out the sacred ministrations, drink neither wine nor any other intoxicating drink, for four most necessary reasons: hesitation, forgetfulness, sleep, and folly. For unmixed wine, by relaxing the powers of the body, makes the limbs more sluggish to move and renders them more hesitant, and forces one into sleep by compulsion. And by loosening the sinews of the soul, it becomes the cause of both forgetfulness and folly. Whereas in the sober man the parts of the body lightened are more readily moved, the senses are purer and clearer, and the mind is sharper sighted, so that he is able both to foresee events and to recall what he has previously seen. In general, then, the use of wine must be considered most unprofitable for all in the conduct of life, since it oppresses the soul, dulls the senses, and weighs down the body. For it leaves nothing in us free and unconstrained, but stands as a hindrance to each faculty in the exercise of its natural function. But in sacred rites and holy ministrations, the harm is more grievous still, inasmuch as sinning against God is more unbearable than sinning against man. Hence it has fittingly been ordained that they sacrifice while sober, for the distinguishing and discerning of holy and profane, of clean and unclean, and of lawful and unlawful. Since the priest is a man well before he is a priest, and must of necessity make use of the impulses toward intercourse, the law arranges for him a marriage with a pure virgin, one born of pure parents, grandparents, and ancestors who have been judged, by the standard of excellence, for their nobility and good birth. For it does not allow him to approach, in body or in soul, a prostitute or a profaned woman, even if she has laid aside her trade and puts on a decent and modest appearance, because her original choice has made her unholy. Toward other men, let her have the pardon due to one who has taken pains to be cleansed of her defilements, for repentance for wrongdoing is praiseworthy, and let no one else be forbidden to marry her, but let her not come near a priest. For the special privileges of the priesthood require a consistency unimpeachable from birth all the way to the end of life. For it would be foolish that scars left on the body by wounds should bar some men from the priesthood, scars that are a token of misfortune, not of wickedness. While women who have sold their own bloom, not only under compulsion, but sometimes even by their own free choice, since they have repented late and reluctantly, should be joined to priests straight from their lovers and moved from brothels into sacred precincts. For the scars and imprints of their former wrongdoings remain in the souls of those who repent no less than scars remain on bodies. It is finely and beautifully said elsewhere, "Do not bring the wage of a prostitute into the sanctuary," Deut. 23:18. And yet the coin itself is not guilty, but only through the woman who received it and the act for which it was given. Much less, then, should one admit into partnership with priests' women whose very money is profane and counterfeit, even if in material and stamp it passes as genuine. So exact is the law's precision about marriage for the high priest that it does not even permit him to marry a widow, whether she has been left alone by her husband's death or separated from him while he still lives, so that first, the sacred seed may go into untrodden and pure soil, and his offspring may take on no admixture from another household. And second, so that in coming together with souls most guileless and unwarped, priests may easily mold their characters and manners. For the minds of virgins are pliant and easily led toward virtue, and most ready to be taught. Whereas a woman who has had experience of another man is naturally more resistant to instruction, since her soul is not utterly unmarked, like a smoothed wax ready for the clarity of doctrines to be inscribed on it, but roughened by imprints already stamped upon it. Imprints that, remaining hard to erase, either refuse to admit other seals or, admitting them, confuse them with their own irregularities. Let the high priest, then, marry a virgin, pure of any previous union. And by virgin, I mean not only one whom no other man has known, but one about whom no other man has even been named through some betrothal, even if she remains bodily chaste. For the priests of lesser rank, the other rules about marriage are laid down the same as for him who holds the highest priesthood, but they are permitted to marry not only virgins, but also widows, not all widows, but those whose husbands have died, without fear. For the law thinks it right to remove rivalries and factions from the priest's life. Toward living rivals, there might arise quarrels from a woman's passion, jealousy, but with the dead, the hostility toward second husbands dies as well. Besides, the law has judged the high priest worthy of a greater sanctity and purification, as in all else, so also in the partnership of marriage, allowing him to take only a maiden. But to those of the second rank, it relaxed the rules concerning unions with women, permitting them to betroth even women who have had experience of other men. In addition, the law was exact also about the lineage of those about to be married, instructing the high priest to court not merely a virgin but a priestess, one of priestly family, so that bridegroom and bride might come from one household and, in a manner, of the same blood, displaying throughout their whole life the most stable blending of characters for harmony. But the others were permitted to marry daughters of men who were not priests, partly because the purifications required of these are slight, and partly because the nation did not wish to be altogether without kinship with, and entirely severed from, a priestly line. For this reason, it did not prevent the other priests from making intermarriages with those of the nation, which are a second kind of kinship. For sons-in-law stand to fathers-in-law in place of sons, and fathers-in-law to sons-in-law in place of fathers. These, then, and matters like them, concern marriage for the sake of the begetting of children. But since corruption follows begetting, Moses also wrote laws for the priests concerning the dead, commanding that they not defile themselves for everyone joined to them in any way, whether by friendship or by kinship, but only for fathers and mothers, sons and daughters, brothers and virgin sisters. But the high priest he exempted from all mourning whatsoever, and rightly so, perhaps. For the services of the other priests can be performed by one in place of another, so that even if some are in mourning, nothing of the customary rites falls short. But no one is permitted to perform the high priest's duties in his place. For this reason, let him remain forever undefiled, never touching a dead body, so that, being always ready, he may perform without hindrance the prayers and sacrifices on behalf of the nation at their appointed times. For besides, having been allotted to God and having become, as it were, the field marshal of the sacred order, he ought to be estranged from everything that belongs to the realm of becoming, not so overcome by affection for parents, children, or brothers, as to pass over or postpone any sacred duty which it is altogether better to perform at once. He commands, then, that the high priest neither tear his garments over the death of his closest kin, nor remove from his head the insignia of the priesthood, nor go out of the sanctuary at all on the pretext of mourning, so that, showing reverence for the place and for the adornments with which he is crowned, and overcoming pity, he may remain forever free of grief. For the law wills that he should have been allotted a nature greater than man's, one that draws nearer to the divine, a border being, if the truth must be told, between the two natures, so that through some intermediary men may propitiate God, and God, using a kind of subordinate minister, may extend and supply his graces to men. Having said this, Moses next legislates immediately about those who shall partake of the first fruits. If then, he says, any of the priests is maimed in his eyes, hands, feet, or any other part of the body, or has received some blemish, let him refrain from ministrations because of the defects that have befallen him, but let him still enjoy the common privileges of the priests, on account of his unimpeachable noble birth. If, however, some outbreak of leprosy takes hold of one, or one of the priests becomes subject to a discharge, let him touch neither the sacred table nor the prizes set out for his kin, until the flux ceases and the leprosy, having changed, comes to resemble the color of healthy flesh. And if a priest touches anything unclean whatsoever, or even, as often happens, has a nocturnal emission, let him partake of none of the consecrated things that day. But once evening has come and he has bathed, let him not be prevented from partaking. Let the resident alien of a priest and his hired servant be barred from the first fruits, the resident alien, since neighbors for the most part share hearth and table. For there is fear that someone, using this as a pretext, might give away the consecrated things out of an untimely kindness, thereby committing impiety. For not all things are to be shared with all people, but only with those fitted to receive them. Otherwise, the finest and most beneficial thing in life, order, will be destroyed, overtaken by the most harmful thing, confusion. For if in merchant ships sailors were to receive an equal share with pilots, and in long triremes rowers and marines an equal share with triarchs and admirals, and in armies cavalrymen an equal share with cavalry commanders, infantrymen with company commanders, captains with generals, and in cities private citizens on trial an equal share with judges, and councilmen with presiding officers and with rulers generally, then disturbances and factions would arise. And equality in words would breed inequality in deeds. For to assign equal things to those unequal in rank is itself inequality, and inequality is a spring of evils. For this reason, the privileges of the priests are not to be given, as to others, even to resident aliens who, because of mere neighborliness, would lay hold of what is not lawful for them. For the honor belongs not to the household, but to the lineage. In like manner, let no one give to a hired servant either wages or recompense for service in the form of a sacred privilege. For the one who receives it will sometimes put it to improper uses, making the prizes of noble birth and of ministry at the temple profane. For this reason, the law does not permit even a foreigner in general to partake of the holy things, even if he happens to be of noble birth among the natives and beyond reproach in the eyes of both men and women, so that the honors may not be counterfeited, but may remain firmly guarded within the priestly order. For it would indeed be absurd that the sacrifices and sacred rites and everything else consecrated about the altar should be entrusted not to all but to the priests alone, while the prizes given in return for these become common property, available even to chance comers, as though it were fitting to wear out the priests with many labors and toils and cares by day and by night, yet to declare the prizes common even to those who do nothing. To the household slave and the one bought with silver, it says, let the priest who is master give a share of food and drink from the first fruits. First, because for a servant his master is his one resource, and the master's allotment is the sacred acts of kindness from which the slave is bound to be fed. Second, because whatever is going to happen must in every case be done willingly by us. But household servants, even if we do not wish it, since they are always present with us and share our daily life, standing by at the food, drink, and delicacies and tables of their masters, and carrying away the leftovers, even if they do not take openly, will at any rate steal them secretly, driven to theft by necessity. So that instead of one charge, if it is even a wrong to be fed from a master's goods, a second is added on top, theft. So that like thieves, they enjoy the things that have been consecrated ahead of those who live blamelessly, which is most absurd. Third, one must also reckon this, that the portion of the first fruits allotted to the household servants will not be diminished on account of the master's watchfulness, for this is sufficient to check the carelessness of some, not permitting them to grow slack. Having added this, he next records a law full of humanity. If a priest's daughter, he says, who is married is widowed from one who is not a priest, whether her husband has died or is still living, and she is left without children, let her return again to her father's house to share once more in the first fruits, in which she also had a part when she was a virgin. For in a sense she is now, in effect, again a virgin, she who is bereft of both husband and children, having no other refuge but her father. But if she has sons or daughters, the mother must remain joined to her children. For sons and daughters, belonging to the house of the one who begot them, draw their mother along with them into it. The privileges of the priests. The law assigned the priests no allotted portion of land, so that, unlike others who reap their livelihood from the earth, they might have an abundance of necessities. Instead, using an excess of honor, he said that God himself was their portion, by a reference made for two reasons. The highest honor, since they thereby become partners with God in the things offered to him in thanksgiving, and also so that they should occupy themselves with only one business, the sacred rites, as though they were stewards of God's allotment. The prizes and rewards he sets before them are these. First, food that is ready, effortless, and free of toil, for he bids those who bake bread take from every batch of dough and every kneading a loaf as first fruits for the priest's use, at the same time providing, by this lawful instruction to those who set the portion aside, for a path leading to piety. For by growing accustomed always to offer first fruits even from their necessary food, they will keep an unforgettable memory of God, than whom no greater good can be found. And since the nation is exceedingly populous, the first fruits too must necessarily be abundant, so that even the poorest of the priests, through this abundance of provisions, seems to be among the most well supplied. Second, he ordains that first fruits be offered also from every other kind of possession. From every winepress, wine. From every thrashing floor, wheat and barley. Likewise oil from the olives and cultivated fruits from the other orchard trees, so that the priests, having not merely the bare necessities, might not live out a rather harsh existence, but, well supplied also with what belongs to a life of comfort, might live more cheerfully in abundance, with fitting adornment. The third privilege is this. All the firstborn males of land animals that serve human use and service. For he bids that these be given over to the priests of oxen, sheep, and goats, the young themselves, calves, rams, and kids, since these are and are reckoned clean both for food and for sacrifice. But for the others, horses, donkeys, camels, and the like, that a ransom be paid instead, without lessening their value. And these too are exceedingly numerous. For those of this nation are among the foremost breeders of cattle and other livestock, pasturing goat flocks, herds of cattle, flocks of sheep, and countless other herds of animals of every kind. Indeed, the law, going further still, commands that first fruits be offered not only from possessions of each kind, but also from one's own souls and bodies. For children are divisible parts of their parents, or rather, to speak truly, indivisible parts, fitted to their offspring by kindred blood, by the accounts of their ancestors, by unseen forms, by the bonds of unifying affection, and by nature's unbreakable ties. Yet even so, he consecrates the firstborn males of these two, in a manner of first fruits, as thank offerings for the good children already born and hoped for, and at the same time wishing that marriages be not merely blameless but altogether praiseworthy, marriages from which the first fruit that springs up is consecrated. Which men and women ought to bear in mind, and so hold fast to self-mastery, care for the household, and concord, breathing together with one another in word and deed, firmly confirming in truth what is called their partnership. As for the consecration of firstborn sons, so that neither parents may be severed from children, nor children from parents, he honors this first fruit with a fixed sum of silver, ordaining that poor and rich alike contribute an equal amount, having regard neither to the standing of those who contribute nor to the health and beauty of those born, but weighing what even the very poor is able to bring. For since the birth of children happens equally among the most distinguished and the most obscure alike, he judged it right to legislate an equal contribution as well, aiming, as I said, chiefly at what is possible for all. After this, he also allots to the priests another resource, not a small one, bidding that first fruits be offered from each source of income, from grain, wine, and oil, and further from the increase of livestock, by flocks of sheep, herds of cattle, herds of goats, and the other herds. And how great an abundance there is of these two, one might reckon from the great populousness of the nation. From all this, it is clear that the law confers upon the priests the dignity and honor of kings. At any rate, just as tribute is commanded to be given to rulers from every kind of possession, so it is given here too, but in the opposite manner from that in which cities pay tribute to their rulers. For cities pay it out of necessity and reluctantly, groaning, eyeing the collectors of money as common plunderers, pleading now this excuse and now that, and disregarding the appointed deadlines as they lay down the fixed taxes and tributes. But those of the nation, rejoicing and delighted over the priestly dues, anticipating those who ask, cutting short the deadlines, thinking that they are receiving rather than giving, make their contributions with words of praise and thanksgiving at each of the yearly seasons, men and women alike, with a self-prompted eagerness, readiness, and zeal beyond all description. These, then, are the portions allotted from each person's possessions, but there are other special revenues, most fitting for priests, from the sacrifices that are brought up to the altar. For it is ordained that from every sacrificial victim two things be given to the priests from two limbs, the shoulder from the right foreleg, and from the breast whatever is fat, the one a symbol of strength, manliness, and every lawful action in giving, receiving, and doing, the other a symbol of the gracious gentleness that tempers the passions. For there is an account that this passion resides in the breast, since nature has assigned the chest as the most fitting place for spirited passion to dwell, and has fitted it around, like a soldier, with a most secure and hard-to-capture fence, the so-called breastplate, which she fashioned out of many close-set and exceedingly strong bones, binding it very firmly with unbreakable sinews. From the animals slaughtered outside the altar for the eating of meat, three things are ordained to be given to the priest: the shoulder, the jaws, and what is called the fourth stomach. The shoulder for the reason stated a little before, the jaws because they belong both to the head, the most authoritative of the limbs, and to speech uttered aloud, of which they are the first fruit, since without their motion the stream of speech could not flow forth. For when they are shaken, from which they also get their fitting name, struck by the tongue, the whole instrument of the voice resounds together. The fourth stomach is an outgrowth of the belly, and the belly, it turns out, is the manger of an irrational creature, desire, which, watered by wine drinking and gluttony, is forever flooded with successive intakes of food and drink together, and delights, like a pig, to live in filth. For this reason, the region of the body's waist has been allotted as most fitting to this unrestrained and most unseemly creature. The opponent of desire is self-mastery, which one must practice, labor at, and strive by every means to acquire as the greatest and most perfect good, of benefit both privately and in common. Desire, then, being profane, impure, and unholy, has rightly been driven beyond the bounds of virtue and banished. But self-mastery, a pure and unstained virtue, disregarding all matters of food and drink and claiming to stand above the pleasures of the belly, may it touch the sacred altars, bringing with it the attachment of the belly as a reminder to hold in contempt insatiable greed and gluttony desire. Then, being profane, unclean, and unholy, has been driven and banished beyond the boundaries of virtue, and rightly so. Self-control, by contrast, a pure and unstained virtue, holding all matters of food and drink beneath its notice and claiming to stand above the pleasures of the belly, may touch the sacred altars and bring with it the clinging attachment of the stomach as a reminder of its contempt for insatiability and gluttony, and for everything that inflames desires. Above all this, however, he commands the priests who minister at the sacrifices to take the hides of the whole burnt offerings. These are countless, not a small but an especially lucrative gift. From this it is clear that, by not assigning to the priestly tribe a single allotment as he did to the others, he gave it a more august and holier resource, under the guise of first fruits taken from every kind of sacrifice. So that none of those who give should reproach those who receive, he orders that the first fruits be brought to the temple first, and only then that the priests take them from there. For it was fitting that those who received benefits in every part of life should offer thank offerings of first fruits to God, and that God, since he lacks nothing, should instead grant them, with all dignity and honor, to the attendants and ministers who serve around the temple. For a gift that seems to be received not from men, but from the universal benefactor, carries an obligation that cannot be disowned. Since such great prizes are laid out, if any of the priests who live orderly and blameless lives are in want, they stand as accusers of our lawlessness, even if they say nothing. For if we obeyed what was commanded and made the first fruit offerings as prescribed, not only would they have an ample supply of necessities, but they would also be filled with all else that supplies a life of comfort. And if ever again the priestly tribe were found in possession of all the abundance that life affords, this would become a great proof of the common piety of the people and of their exact observance of the laws in every particular. But the negligence of some, for it is not safe to accuse everyone, has become the cause of poverty for the priesthood, and, to tell the truth, for the people themselves as well. For lawlessness is costly to the lawless, even if it entices for a short time, while following the laws of nature is most beneficial, even if it seems harsh for the moment and shows nothing pleasant. Having granted the priests so many sources of income, he did not neglect those in the second rank either. These are the temple attendants. Of these, some are stationed at the doors as gatekeepers right at the entrances. Others are within at the forecourt to prevent anyone, whether willingly or unwillingly, from stepping where it is not permitted. Others patrol in a circuit, having drawn lots in turn for night and day, serving as day watchmen and night watchmen, and others sweep the porticos and the open courts and carry out the sweepings, attending to cleanliness. To all of these the tithes were appointed as wages, for this is the allotted portion of the temple attendants. The law, at any rate, did not allow those who received the tithes to use them until they had, in turn, offered other tithes as though from their own possessions and given them to the priests of the higher rank. Only then did it permit them to enjoy their portion, but not before. He also assigned to them 48 cities, and around each one suburbs extending 2,000 cubits in a circle, for the pasturing of livestock and for the other services that are necessary to cities. Of these, 6 were set apart by lot, 3 on each side of the river Jordan, as places of refuge for those who commit involuntary manslaughter. For since it was not lawful for one who had in any way become the cause of a person's death to pass within the sprinkling vessels, using the temple as a refuge for his safety, he set aside the cities just mentioned as secondary sanctuaries, possessing great inviolability because of the special privilege and honor accorded to their inhabitants, who were to preserve their suppliants safe, should some stronger force try to compel their surrender, not by preparations for war, but by the dignities and privileges which they held under the laws on account of the sanctity of the priesthood. Let the exile be confined within the boundaries of the city to which he has fled, on account of the avengers lying in wait, who, being relatives of the dead man, out of longing for their kinsmen, thirst for the blood of the killer, even if the killing was unintentional, the private passion overpowering the exact reckoning of justice. And let him know that if he goes outside, he will proceed toward certain destruction, for he will escape the notice of none of the blood relatives, by whom he will at once be caught, as in nets and snares, and done away with. Let the term of his exile be the lifetime of the high priest, at whose death he may return, having been granted amnesty. Having legislated these and similar matters concerning the priests, he next teaches about the animals suitable for sacrifices.